One of the reasons for addressing this is because you have a long tradition of readers, interpreters of the Song of Songs who read it as an allegory. This has been the majority Christian interpretation through most of the history of the church. Christian preachers and commentators on the book have seen it as a depiction of the love of Christ for his church and the responding love of the church for Christ. And that was true from the very earliest commentaries. The earliest one we still have is by Origen. It's a second century church father in Alexandria, and wrote an extensive commentary on the Song of Songs. And that's the way that he was reading it. Bernard of Clairvaux, probably know from O Sacred Head, Now Wounded. He wrote a lot of poetry, but that's probably the hymn we know of his. But he did a series of homilies on the Song of Songs in the Middle Ages that, I can't remember how many there are, there's maybe 80 or 90, and he got up through, you know, the first few verses of chapter 2. five sermons on the kiss, and then, five sermons on the morning. And it's all allegorical interpretation. The bride is the church. The bride is Christ.
Can you give a working definition of allegory?
I'm going to get to that. I was going to ask you. I'm going to get to you. I was going to get to that, and I was going to ask everyone to throw in their two cents. So there's that tradition, and we think of that as a Catholic or early church tradition, maybe. But if you read some of the Puritans on the Song of Songs, they're doing the same thing. So. Luther wrote on the Song of Songs, and he interpreted some differently, but still allegorical. But then in Reformed churches, you have still an interest of Puritan commentators for a long time. And for up until the last few centuries, I think it was predominantly interpreted as an allegorical poem, or interpreted allegorically. And that's all within the Christian tradition. Behind that, you have what appears to be a long-standing Jewish tradition that sees the Song of Songs as an allegory, this time, of course, of Yahweh and Israel. So they're in the Targum, which is the Targum of the Song of Songs, which is kind of ancient Jewish commentary of the Song of Songs. The book is divided up into different phases of Israel's history. So the Targum treats it as a poetic retelling of the whole history of Israel and God. So there are parts of it that are talking about the Exodus, and parts of it that are talking about the reign of the kings and the exile and the longing for the return from exile. And then the book ends, the book comes to its conclusion, but it's an open-ended conclusion. The bride speaking, "Hurry, my beloved, be like a gazelle or like a young stag on the mountains of spices," which is the Jews took as an expression of longing for the coming of Messiah. So it takes you through the history of Israel and Yahweh, but looks ahead to this future arrival of the bridegroom. Israel is still waiting for that in the Targum's interpretation. So that's been the majority interpretation of this book by Christians and by Jews throughout the centuries. And my questions are going to be, basically, is this a legitimate way to read the book? What signals do we have in the book itself that it might be legitimate to read it that way? What signals might we have elsewhere in the Bible that we should read the Song of Songs as an allegory? So that set of questions about whether this is a good reading of the book. And then, if it is, then what is the book actually teaching us? If this is about Christ and the church, or as some commentators have said, Christ and the soul, that's usually in Bernard of Clairvaux, for example, that's the relationship that he's talking about. If that's the case, then what are we supposed to learn from it? What do we learn about God, if this is about God and his people? What do we learn about our life before God? What is this book supposed to contribute? So, back to Pastor Russ's question. What is allegory? I want to start there and just get your initial impressions or initial response to that question. How would you describe or define allegory?
I don't remember. It's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's like a story that's not supposed to be taken literally. Like it's, each part stands for something else. It's kind of a metaphor, I guess.
Okay.
It paints a moral picture or a moral political picture.
Okay. And is that, does it do that in a particular way?
Usually through a poem.
Okay. You put those two together, and I think you're getting a good definition. Where allegory is a story told, but with always with a second. What the story is really about is not what's on the page, but some secondary thing, which is often a moral. It's got a moral dimension to it. Sometimes a philosophical dimension. There's a tradition of reading certain texts philosophically. They have some kind of somebody represents a certain. The soul or some philosophical principle. So somebody give me an example of an allegory. Do you know any allegories?
The Song of Solomon?
Is it? That's the question of the day.
Pilgrim's Progress.
Pilgrim's Progress is always my default example. Right? So have you all read Pilgrim's Progress? Mm-hmm. Or at least know of it? Mm-hmm. Does anybody want to describe Pilgrim's Progress? Anyone?
Christian's journey through.
And who's Christian?
Christian is Christian. The main character. So it's essentially depicting a Christian named Christian. Journey through various temptations on his way to essentially what's heaven or Christ.
The Book of Revelations, maybe?
Okay.
Because it's not literally, there's not literally like a seven-headed dragon coming down as the beast.
Right. Yeah, certainly parts of Revelation would qualify as allegory in a strict sense. So Pilgrim's Progress says Christian is living in the city of City of Destruction, is that the name of it? Not a good place to settle. He should have known just from the name. And he's told he needs to get out. And so he starts out on this journey and keeps meeting people. Like Mr. Worldly Wise Man. Guess what he's up to? Or Faithful. Or he goes to a place called Vanity Fair. There's a Vanity Fair is a fair in a town square, and everything's for sale. So, and he encounters various people in various situations, and they all have, they all are characters in the story, but they're obviously representing something else in addition. So yeah, Pilgrim's Progress is a good example.
How would you say allegory relates to the parables of Jesus?
Yeah. You're just the straight man tonight.
Oh, wow. I'll keep my mouth shut.
I was going to get
there. I just don't get to ask a lot of questions.
I was going to look at some biblical examples of what I think are qualified as allegories. Sometimes there's a distinction maybe between allegory and typology, and I think that distinction is kind of blurry, but if there's a difference, it would be, this is the way to explain it, that allegory is a story where the characters represent some higher truths, usually a physical story, real events that are supposed to represent some spiritual reality. And typology is a story that is foreshadowing something that's going to happen later on in the story, or it's an episode that's foreshadowing something later on in the story. So it's a historical event that becomes a picture of a later historical event. So you don't go from the physical historical world to some spiritual world. You go from early to later. But historically, when Christians talk about allegory, they're often talking about what I've just described as typology. So distinction is not a real sharp. One distinction I do want to make before I look at some passages. And that's between an allegory and an allegorical interpretation of a text. Those are two different things. Pilgrim's Progress is written intentionally as an allegory. Bunyan suddenly, John Bunyan. Why did I lose this? It is John Bunyan. Right? Suddenly, I lost his first name. Paul Bunyan, all kinds of other Bunyans. John Bunyan wrote the poem, wrote the story, deliberately to represent something else. And that's really obvious from the names and the events you can tell. But then there can be, I think, another fairly obvious allegorical fiction novel story is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is pretty clearly allegory, at least certain parts of it would be. But then you can also have texts that are not clearly allegorical. It's not clear that the author intended them that way, but you can read them as an allegory. And this has been, again, customary in a lot of the Christian and Jewish tradition to read parts of the Bible which don't claim to be allegorical as allegories. So, and this is where allegory gets a bad name, because it takes texts that look like they're just straightforward historical narratives and turns them into something else. Philo of Alexandria was a Jewish scholar. Wrote books on the Old Testament, many books on the Old Testament, also on real other philosophical subjects. But he did a number of books on Old Testament narratives and did allegorical interpretations of them. So you take the life of Abraham, for example, and different events in the life of Abraham become allegories of the struggles of the human soul or the struggles of the virtuous man. The life of virtue. Abraham goes down to Egypt with Sarah, his wife, and while he's there, Pharaoh tries to take Sarah into his harem, and the Lord brings plagues and delivers him. And Philo took that as an allegory about Abraham as a virtuous man going down into and being attacked by Pharaoh, Pharaoh in Egypt, which represents kind of a life that's purely fleshly and sensual, but he's delivered from that. I can't remember what role she plays in that. Or the combat between, when Abraham comes out of Egypt, he has to fight against the five kings against the four. There's five kings of Canaan against four kings of Canaan, and Abraham intervenes in that because Lot has been captured, his nephew, and he goes to rescue Lot. But Philo takes that narrative. He recounts the narrative as a literal historical event, but he says it's really a war between the four passions and the five senses. And Abraham is intervening in the war to put a proper balance back between the passions and the senses, because you can't have one dominating the other. And the life in a virtuous life, you have the senses and the passions working together. So that would be an allegorical interpretation of a text that doesn't appear to be allegorical. It looks like it's just the narrative of the life of Abraham. But Philo is reading it and looking for kind of moral, he's looking for moral drama in the story of Abraham. So he's moving from this historical level up into a spiritual level, a moral level. So as far as the Bible, I do want to, one of the questions I want to raise was, given that distinction between allegories and allegorical readings of stories or poems, I wanted to look at some passages of the Bible where it's obvious that they're intended to be allegories. So there clearly are allegories in Scripture. That doesn't mean that everything in the Bible should be interpreted allegorically, but there are certain things that are clearly written to be allegories. So, for example, I won't read these passages, all of which are fairly long. Go to Ezekiel. Ezekiel's after Lamentations. Go to Ezekiel 16. Ezekiel listen. And as you listen, it might be better to listen because it might give it away. As you listen, what do you think this narrative is actually talking about? It says, as for your birth, on the day that you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water for cleansing. You were not rubbed with salt or even wrapped in cloths. No, I looked with pity on you to do any of the things for you to have compassion on you. Rather, you were thrown out into an open field, for you were abhorred on the day that you were born. When I passed by and saw you squirming in your blood, I said to you, while you're in your blood, live. I said to you, while you're in your blood, live. That was in the text, the repetition. I'm not repeating myself. I made you numerous like the plants of the field. Then you grew up, became tall, and reached the age of fine adornments. Your breasts were formed and your hair had grown, yet you were naked and bare. Then I passed by you and saw you, and behold, you were at the time for love. So I spread my skirt over you and covered your nakedness. I also swore to you and entered into a covenant with you, so that it became mine. Then I bathed you with water, washed off your blood from you, and anointed you with oil. He also clothed you with embroidered cloth and put sandals of porpoise skin on your feet. I wrapped you with fine linen and covered you with silk. I adorned you with ornaments, put bracelets on your hands, and a necklace around your neck. I put a ring in your nostril, earrings in your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. Thus you were adorned with gold and silver, and your dress was of fine linen, silk, and embroidered cloth. You ate fine flour, honey, and oil, and so you were exceedingly beautiful and advanced in royalty. And then your fame went forth among all the nations on account of your beauty, for it was perfect because of my splendor which I bestowed on you. Okay. Then things go bad after that. You may be familiar with the passage already, but who's speaking, who's the I in the passage, and what is he talking about?
Could it be an allegory for Christ and the church?
Okay.
God and the nation of Israel.
Okay, right. So it's Christ and the church in a sense, but in the Old Testament setting, it's Yahweh and Israel. So Yahweh is the one who finds Israel as a newborn. That's really clear if you read the first couple of verses that I skipped. Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, your origin and your birth was from the land of Canaan. Your father was an Amorite and your mother was a Hittite. And then it goes on to describe the Lord finding Israel, newborn, helpless, abandoned. He takes Israel, raises Israel, covers Israel, enters into a covenant with Israel. Adornments, the clothing, the adornments, and the ornaments, and so on, all had links with the tabernacle. Porpoise skin feet, not porpoise skin feet, porpoise skin shoes on our feet. There's only a few times that porpoise skin is mentioned in the Bible. One of them is in the tabernacle. There's porpoise skin coverings put over the tabernacle. So it's an allegory using a romance as a portrait of Yahweh's relationship with Israel. How about this one? This one is the next chapter of Ezekiel, actually. And this one actually is signaled as an allegory, or at least a riddle. Now the word of the Lord came to me, Son of man, propound a riddle, and speak a parable to the house of Israel, saying, thus says Yahweh, Master Yahweh, a great eagle with great wings, long pinions, and full plumage of many colors came to Lebanon, and took away the top of the cedar. He plucked off the topmost of its young twigs and brought it to the land of merchants, he said, in a city of traders. He also took some of the seed of that land and planted it in the fertile soil. He placed it beside abundant waters, he said, like a willow. Then it sprouted and became a low spreading vine with its branches turned toward him, but its roots remained under it. So it became a vine and yielded shoots and set out branches. There was another great eagle with great wings and much plumage. Behold, this vine bent its roots toward him and sent out its branches toward him. In the beds where it was planted, that he might water it. It was planted in good soil beside abundant waters, that it might yield branches and bear fruit, and become a splendid vine. Say, thus says Master Yahweh, will it thrive? Will he not pull it up by the roots by the roots and cut off its fruit, that it withers, so that all its sprouting leaves wither? And neither by great strength nor by many people can it be raised from its roots again. Behold, though it was planted, will it thrive? Will it not completely wither as soon as the east wind strikes it? Whether on the beds where it grew, and then it goes on, and the Lord goes on to just explain this story, which is not nearly as familiar to us, but it's an eagle just snapping off the topmost branches of a cedar tree and going and planting it elsewhere. And as the Lord explains it, well, any guesses? If you don't, if you know the passages about it. Any guesses about what that would be talking about? A tree in Lebanon, that's part of which is replanted, the topmost part. Anybody know when Ezekiel was written?
Isn't it after the exile?
During.
During.
Ezekiel is in exile. He's writing from Babylon. Does that help? So it's the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, snapping off the topmost branches of the tree of Israel. Those are the highest, and the nobles and great men of the land that are taken off in exile, replanted somewhere else. There's another great evil that comes into play. That's another empire. So there's this is an allegory of exile. But we know that. We know it's going to be an allegory because he tells us at the beginning it's a riddle and a parable. Doesn't use the word allegory, but those are equivalent terms in the lesson. One last example, according to where Pastor was suggested we go, which is the parables of Jesus. And you probably have heard the idea that the parables of Jesus are not allegories, that they have only a single message to them, a single central message. But I don't think that's accurate. I think that it's clear when Jesus interprets his parables, that he sees correspondences between the particular characters in the parable and the things that happen in the story with particular people, and usually the people that and events that are going on around Jesus. Usually he's not talking about some general truth. He's talking about the things that are happening around him. Just as an example of that, the parable of the prodigal son is in Luke 15. And it's a parable about a younger son who has wandered away and now comes home. His father throws a big feast for him, and there's somebody grumbling about the feast, the older brother. And Jesus tells that parable, we know from the beginning of the chapter, he tells that parable while he's feasting with sinners, and the Pharisees are grumbling about him. Well, this parable of the prodigal son is not just a generic tale of redemption. It's really a story about the Pharisees. The elder brother is the key to the whole story, because that's who he's talking to. He tells a series of stories in Luke 15 about things that are lost that are found, and the joy that people have when they find them. And he's talking about what's happening right in front of him. He's talking about what he's doing. Pastor Les was pointing this out on Sunday, that the miracles in the parables are functioning like the miracles in the Gospels. They're signs of the kingdom. They're about the kingdom that Jesus is bringing. So when Jesus does interpret a parable, he doesn't interpret all of them. But when he gives us detailed interpretations, they're pretty straightforward allegorical. This is in Matthew 13, which is a parable chapter in Matthew. This is Jesus' explanation of the parable of the sower, which I won't read the parable. It goes out and sows the seed, and it goes on different sorts of soil. And this is what Jesus says in explanation. This is Matthew 13, verse 18. Hear then the parable of the sower. When anyone hears the word of the kingdom and does not understand it, the evil one comes in and snatches what had been sown in his heart. This is the one who has the seed sown beside the road. And so a seed on a particular kind of soil corresponds to the word of God preached. It falls on soil, and then Satan comes and snatches it away. The one on whom the seed was sown on the rocky places, this is the man who hears the word and immediately receives it with joy. He has no firm ground within him. It's only temporary, and when his affliction or persecution arises because the word, immediately falls away. Another kind of ground, another kind of sowing, and it corresponds to another kind of response to the preaching of the word. the one on whom seed was sown among the thorns, this is the man who hears the word, and the word of the Lord and the deceitfulness of riches choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. And then, of course, the seed on the good soil produces fruit. So each one of the kinds of seed and the kinds of ground correspond to, or each one of the kinds of ground corresponds to a particular kind of person. This fits with biblical theology because people are made of dirt. Adam was made of dirt. And when seed goes into dirt and produces fruit, that's like words going into a person made of dirt and producing fruit or not, depending on what kind of ground that the person is. So, when Jesus explains the parable, he's got everything corresponds, every particular in the parable corresponds to something else, corresponds to some set of events that are going on around him. So I think the parables of Jesus generally are of that sort. He's talking about, he's basically telling allegories. The word parable and the word is in the Old Testament serves for stories, allegories, proverbs. Okay. We also have, before, we'll get back to the Song of Songs in a second, but we also have examples in the New Testament of the apostles interpreting things in the Old Testament allegorically, even when it doesn't appear that those Old Testament stories were intended to be allegories. There is one place in the Bible where the word allegory actually appears. You may know where that is. The sentence is, "This is allegorically speaking." Who does that sound like? Who would you guess would say something? I heard it. It's Paul. You may know where. It's in Galatians. And I'll read, this is the last part of Galatians 4. And in Galatians, Paul is addressing Jewish believers who say that in order to be a follower of Christ, you also have to follow all the Jewish regulations. And the specific things that are at issue are circumcision, food laws, purity laws, those sorts of ceremonial laws. And the whole book of Galatians, letter of Galatians, is designed to refute those people, those Judaizers, as Paul calls them, where he says they Judaize. It says, "Tell me," verse 21 of chapter 4, "you who want to be under the law, do not listen to the law. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a bondwoman and one by a free woman. But the son by the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, the son by the free woman through the promise." He's talking about Abraham with Sarah and Sarah his wife, and Hagar, Sarah's servant, with whom Abraham had a son, Ishmael. Then verse 24, this is allegorically speaking. And now Paul's going to give an allegorical interpretation of that incident in the life of Abraham. "These two women are two covenants, one proceeding from Mount Sinai, bearing children who were to be slaves. She is Hagar. Now this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, for she is in slavery with her children, but the Jerusalem above is free. She is our mother." That corresponds to Sarah. "For it is written, rejoice, barren woman who does not bear. Bring forth and shout, you are not in labor. For more are the children of the desolate than the one who has a husband. And you, brethren, like Isaac, are children of promise. But as at that time he was born according to the flesh, persecuted him who was born according to the spirit, so also it is now." So those who are born according to the flesh, in the Old Testament story, that's Ishmael. The one born according to the spirit is Isaac. And in Paul's own time, there are people born according to the flesh. Those are the Judaizers. And they're persecuting the ones who are born according to the Spirit, who are the Christians who don't Judaize. But what does the scripture say? He says, "Cast out the bondwoman and her son, the son of the bondwoman shall not be an heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free woman. That's a really complicated passage. But the main thing I want to point out is that Paul takes a story that in the Old Testament looks just like a straightforward historical episode, and is, but he says that this is, you can, he reads it allegorically as a portrait, as a preview of what's happening in the first century church. And the conflict between Ishmael and Isaac in Genesis becomes a foreshadowing of the conflict between Judaizers and others within within Paul's own time. So there we have an example, not of an allegory, not of a text that was written as an allegory, but of a text that doesn't seem to be allegorical, but Paul did an allegorical interpretation of it. Or, again, we would probably attempt to use the word typological to describe that. Okay, that's all by way of background. Any questions about that if we actually look at the Song of Solomon? I want to do a couple things here. One is to suggest some reasons for thinking that the Song of Songs is was intended to be not only a love poem, which it obviously is, but also intended to be by the writer, Solomon, intended to be an allegory of Christ and the church. And there are a couple things in the song itself that indicate that. These are fairly subtle, but to me, they are convincing. I think they should be convincing to you too, just because they're convincing to me. There is one place in the Song of Songs where a shortened version of God's name is used. Okay? Sometimes you'll read that the Song of Songs is just like Esther and never uses the name of God. But that's not entirely true, because at the end of the book, at the end of the poem, in the theme verses of the poem, some of the verses that are the most popular, not necessarily the most popular ones, we have the name Yah, Y-A-H, which is a shortened version of Yahweh, which is the covenant name of God. That's in the Hebrew is actually attached on the end of another word. So in chapter 8, verse 6, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is as strong as death, and jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of Yah. Very flame of the Lord you have in some translations. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will water or rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all his riches of his house for love, it would be utterly destroyed. Some of you might not have the name Yahweh or the Lord in your translation.
Mine has the most vehement flames.
Most vehement. What do the rest of you have? Lord? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question there is whether sometimes people interpret this, it's the word flame with the word Yah at the end. You know, sometimes a lot of times you have names in the Bible that are built from some verb in the name Yah. Zedekiah is Yah is righteous. Zechariah is Yah remembers. So that fragment is often used as attached to other words. Some people would interpret that as kind of a superlative. It's the name of Yah, but all it's saying is that it's a flame that is a divine-sized flame or a flame of divine intensity. But I think it's better to take it as an actual reference to the name Yah. So these are the climactic verses of the song. They're stating something about the character of love. Love is as strong as death, and its jealousy is as severe as Sheol. It's saying something about the power of love. And then the rest of verse 6 tells us something about the source of that power. It's flashes of fire, the very flame of Yah. In godly human love, the very fire of God's own love, is at work. The flashes of human love, the thing that makes it as strong as death, is the fact that God is at work in it. So there's a... We get to the end of the poem, or near the end of the poem, and we realize that the love that's being described through the whole poem is actually something that's a little spark that's coming off the flame of the Lord. And then we can reread the whole poem and realize that when it's, you know, when these two lovers are talking to each other, what's behind that and in and with it all is the Lord's own love. So I think at that point, the not only is that, I think, an explicit reference to the Lord's name, but it also, its position in the poem, it's kind of surprising. Could you be reading the whole poem and it just sounds like a love poem, and then suddenly Yahweh's name comes into it at the end. And it's, oh, there's something else, there's another level going on here that I might not have noticed at first. And you go back and read it, and there's this allegory that's running through the whole thing. Another indication in the poem itself, I think there are lots of indications, but another indication, this doesn't come out at all in the English translation, but and it's pretty obscure. I think it's just cool, so I'll say it. There are a couple things that have to do with the name of the lover, or the title for the lover throughout the poem. I mentioned last week that the Hebrew word for my beloved is Dodi. Dode means beloved. The E on the end is a first-person possessive pronoun. Dodi means my beloved. And that word in the Hebrew text is used 26 times in Song of Songs, which doesn't sound like it's particularly significant. And you probably wouldn't even think the number of times that word is used. But ancient writers did. They used numerical patterns a lot. We'll see another one, not as elaborate as this, but another one that will do. But the number 26, this requires some explanation, the number 26 is the numerical value of the name of Yahweh. Each of the Hebrew letters, those of you who are at the Biblical Horizons Conference, taste that is not always real straightforward. But there is a real thing going on. Each of the Hebrew letters has a numerical value. And the ancient Hebrews used those letters to represent certain numbers, and they have certain symbolic value frequently. If you add up the letters of the name Yahweh, you get the number 26, which is the number of times that Dodi is mentioned here, which I think is a very subtle, super subtle indication of who the Dodi is. Who is this beloved that the woman is talking about? Another thing about that name, Dodi, in Hebrew, the O letter, and is the same as the V letter. I know that sounds weird, but it is. It's a vowel with a certain vowel pointing. It's an O sound. Without the vowel pointing, it's a V sound. So D O D, Dalet, Vav, Dalet. Those are the letters. Dalet, Vav, Dalet. Those are the letters for beloved. They're also the letters for the name David. So Dodi all the way through it. So if you're looking at the Hebrew text, it would just as easily be, you could just as easily read it, my David. The bride is longing for and looking for and in love with a David. And that brings all this messianic hope into the poem. Think about the somewhat odd circumstance of Solomon writing a poem like this. But I think Solomon is aware that there's a future king, a future son of David, another David that's yet to come. But he's not the one. He's the son of David, the immediate son of David. But the longing of the song shows us there's another David yet to come. There's this messianic overtone to the whole poem. Every time the bride speaks, my beloved, she is longing for the future Messiah. That's part of the And you got sort of this overlapping thing with the name, the numerical value, the number of times it's used, the numerical value of that, and the use of the name for David. All those are involved in that. I think we also have some indications in passages in the New Testament that refer to the Song of Songs. And I'll look at just one of those for the sake of time. You were beginning to ask a question.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that with the beloved and with David. Do you think that is something that's intentionally ambiguous in the text, so it's intended that we would read it both ways at the same time, basically?
Yeah, I think so.
Rather than saying it either means this or it means this,
right.
It's got an intentional ambiguity.
Right. I think that's right. And that's a fairly common device in the Bible, both in Old and New Testament. And this would add a little bit of something to that. Just the character of Hebrew. You may know that Hebrew has 22 consonant letters, but the original Hebrew text, the oldest Hebrew texts, don't have any vowels. And at some point, the Hebrews invented vowels, which are dots and dashes and things that are usually under the vowel, under the consonants, sometimes in the middle of consonants. But if you have an unpointed text without the vowels, my David and my beloved are identical. They're the same consonants. So if somebody's reading an ancient text, I think that would strike them immediately. Okay, I was going to look at one passage in the New Testament that I think clearly refers to the Song of Songs. And again, part of my reason for saying this, the reason for pointing this out is the main reason is to show that we're justified in reading the Song of Songs as an allegory of Yahweh and Israel, Christ and the Church, and drawing conclusions about it. Does somebody want to read Song of Songs 5:2?
Yeah.
Thank you. And then somebody else can look up Revelation 3, 20 through 22. Jessica, you can start with the Song of Songs.
All right, Song of Songs 5:2. I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, "Open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night."
Okay. So, just to make sure we see what's happening there. You got the bride asleep. The beloved is standing outside the door, knocking and seeking entry. Who's got the Revelation passage?
Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and eat with him, and he with me. The one who conquers, I will grant him to sit with me on my throne, as I also conquered and sat down with my Father on his throne. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches.
Okay, good, thanks. It's pretty good, verse 20 of that passage. What are the things that are common between the two?
Door knocking.
Anything else? I guess that's added. There's reference to the voice in my translation. Yeah, that's in my translation of Revelation 3:20. So a knocking and a voice outside. So, if you read the two passages together, what does that say about the Revelation text? Who is Jesus from the perspective of the Song of Songs? Sorry?
The Beloved.
Right, he's the Beloved. And here's the Church of Laodicea, who's in the position of the sleeping bride. Laodicea, as you might know, is the one that Jesus says is lukewarm, neither hot nor cold. But Jesus is standing outside seeking entry. He's the lover, and wanting to enter in order to dine with the church, he says. But that picks up on imagery from the Song of Songs also, because just before the verse that you read, Jessica, there's this description of the feast of the two lovers. Jesus is the lover who seeks entry in order to have a love feast with his bride. It's in the marriage supper of the Lamb, to pick up imagery from later in the book of Revelation. So there you have a passage that is using the Song of Songs scene and clearly applying it to Jesus. Jesus is the lover, and I could spend more time with this. I just assert this for the moment. But the book of Revelation is full of Song of Songs echoes. But John and Revelation together are full of echoes of the Song of Songs. One thing I can point to as a further hint of that is the very last verse of the Bible, last two verses of the Bible. Last few verses of the Bible. Not quite the last verse. Mm-hmm. Revelation 22:17, the Spirit and the Bride say, come. And let the one who hears say, come. And let the one who is thirsty come, and let him who wishes take the water of life without cost. So this Spirit and the Bride together are longing for the coming of Jesus. But if it's the bride longing for the coming of Jesus, then Jesus is the bridegroom. At the end of the Bible, they're still looking ahead, as at the end of the Song of Songs, there still is looking ahead to a coming of, to a return of the bridegroom. So the book of Revelation is agreed as a romance, as an allegory of the love of Christ in the church. Okay, so if that's more or less compelling, what do we learn from that? Just make a couple of comments on a few passages. If Song of Songs is about Christ, the bridegroom, and the bride, his church, what are we supposed to learn from this about our life with God? I think four things I want to mention, which I probably won't have time. I won't have time for all of them. I mentioned the first couple. We can pick up the rest next time. The passage that I read at the beginning of our study, go back to the Song of Songs 2. And here, the beloved, think of this as Jesus, the bride who's being called out is the church. And what we have, particularly in verses 10 through 13 or so, is the beloved, the bridegroom, Jesus, calling his beautiful one out to springtime. You've got this nice, neat little poem in verses 11 through 13. About the end of winter and the coming of spring. It's a seven-line poem. It's a small new creation poem. It's got seven lines, like the 7 days of creation. And the bridegroom is calling the bride out to share in the new life of spring. Okay. And the beauties and the abundance of the world that's now thawing. Things are bearing fruit. Birds are singing. Fig trees ripen, and so on. That's a portrait of Jesus called to his bride. It starts out with a call to arise, my beloved. She's inside, perhaps sleeping. She's been called from, perhaps from sleep, perhaps from death, into a world that's made new. Springtime. It's a little picture of, those verses are a little picture of Jesus' call to us as a call from Jesus, the lover of his church, to share a new world with him, to enjoy the beauties and glories of creation, the new creation that he's making. So we can, there's passages like that throughout where the bridegroom is calling on the bride to come out and share, come out into the world with him, come out into the mountains with him. And those are all Christ's call to his bride. One of the things that, this is a second point, one of the things that's particularly interesting about Song of Songs is that it's a romantic poem, but it's full of, let me put it this way, it's not a story of undiminished or untainted bliss between the two lovers. It's a, there are moments of desperation in the poem. There are moments of separation, like the one at the beginning of chapter 3. Let me read the first few verses there. On my bed, night after night, I saw him whom my soul loves. I saw him, but I did not find him. I must arise now and go about the city and the streets and the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but did not find him. The watchman who made the rounds of the city found me, and I said, "Have you seen him whom my soul loves?" Scarcely have I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held on to him without knowing until I had brought him to my mother's house, into the room of her who conceived me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles upon the hinds of the field, that you will not arouse her from my love until she pleases. And then in chapter 5, I mentioned last week, we have a similar scene, we just read the beginning of, where she's asleep. Dodi comes knocking at the door. She goes through the door and he's gone, and she goes out of the street searching for him again. And this time she meets the watchman and they beat her and they strip off her shawl. So you have these moments in the midst of this, love poem, you have these moments of separation and crisis. And even at the beginning, when the bride begins speaking right at the beginning of the poem, she's longing for the presence of her lover, who doesn't seem to be there. Let him kiss me, the kiss of his mouth. His love is better than wine. Draw me after your lips. Even the opening lines, it feels like there's a kind of desperation and longing for a full presence that she's not yet enjoying. Which I think both as a description of human love and as an allegory of our relationship with God, in, on both of those registers, it's a profoundly realistic description of life. There is always, in any love that you have for another human being, there are always moments of separation, of crisis, of searching, of absence. There's no other human being, human being that can be utterly and completely present, utterly and completely one with you. And the, imagining that we can achieve that kind of unity, I think, leads to a good deal of disappointment. You know, as soon as there's some kind of tension or crisis in a relationship, then people just don't know what to do because they have these expectations that we're just going to be at one forever. When people have the same kind of expectations sometimes, and are encouraged to have these kind of expectations in their walk with Jesus. Jesus won't ever leave you. He won't ever be confused. It won't ever feel like he's gone. But that's nobody experiences that. Everyone who's ever written with any depth about the life of the Christian life has recognized that there are times of absence and dark nights of the soul. The mystical tradition of the Christian church talks a lot about the desert of the soul. There are times when, as in the Psalms, you're like a heart panting for water in a dry, thirsty land. We're longing for a God who's not there, a God who we know is there, but who seems to be absent, who seems to have gotten up in the middle of the night and gone away. And I think the Song of Songs not only shows us that we can, that's just part of the love, that's part of the love affair that we have with the Lord. But it also shows us, I think, something of the response that we should have. When the bride finds that the bridegroom is up and gone, she's willing to go out into the streets. You know, I mean, you think about this in the light of the early chapters of Proverbs. The woman who's prowling the streets at night looking for men is not the virtuous Lady Wisdom. These are the actions of Lady Folly, the prostitute. But the bride is so desperate to find her lover that she shames herself. She kind of humiliates herself and takes on the persona of the Lady Folly in searching for it. That's how strongly her passion drives her to be reunited with her lover. And even in the second, episode when they're separated, she goes out into the streets and she's beaten back by the watchman. So how do we respond when the Lord seems to be distant from us? I think the Song of Songs is giving, along with a lot of songs, but the Song of Songs is a rich depiction of what we should, how we should respond. We should seek Him with all our whole heart, even if He seems to be absent from us, even if we can't tell that He's there. Okay, one last thing. Let me end with this, and I'll pick up some other things next time. Go to chapter 4. I won't read the last part of chapter 3. I'm going to do that this time. But go to chapter 4. And again, beginning of chapter 4, again, we're thinking about the poem now as an allegory of Christ and the church, of God and Israel. And what is this opening? This is one of the wasps of the poem. What is this opening wasp telling us about our relationship with God? How beautiful you are, my darling, how beautiful you are. Your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats that have descended from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of newly shorn ewes which have come up from their washing, all of which bear twins, and not one of them has lost your young. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely, and your temples are like a slice of pomegranate behind your veil. Your neck is like the Tower of David, built with rows of stones on which are hung a thousand shields, all around shields of winding in. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle, which feed among the lilies. Until the cool of the day, when the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. And this is a particular verse. After all that, he says, you are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no blemish in you. So think about this, that passage, as the words of a divine lover to his people. And what is being said? Lots of things being said. How would you summarize that?
Well, like in the first verse, your eyes are like doves behind your veil. Doves is commonly a symbol of all the spirit, and the eye is the light of the body. And so you can see the spirit's illumination teaching us God's word.
Good.
I mean, and then it says, all in all, I mean, we are a fallen people, and we're full of, I guess, dirtiness, but when He looks at us, there's no spot in you, so that we're cleansed and forgiven.
Right. Yeah, good. Yeah, I think each of the comparisons does have its significance, specifically significant. I think the eyes, there's a lot of directions you go with the eyes dove connection. I think the Holy Spirit is invoked there. But overall, verse 7 is where I wanted to go with it. Overall, these are the words of Christ through His bride. And they are words of delight. Jesus is captivated by His bride. Jesus is fascinated by her beauty. And He considers us and regards us as having no blemish. Use this as a text to teach about justification by faith alone. Because that's what this is. But it's justification by faith alone, in not in a courtroom context, but in a romantic context. Jesus looks on His bride with the eyes of a lover, and therefore sees no blemish. He's taken care of all the blemishes, and so He accepts her as totally cleansed and pure. And not just cleansed and pure, but beautiful, desirable. If take it that way, then this is saying something about, it's true about us, regardless of how we might regard ourselves. We might not find ourselves very desirable, but that's that just means we have to accept in faith Jesus' evaluation of us. He says we are. He says we are without blemish. That's what's ultimately true about us, no matter how we might feel about it. And I think it's deeply reassuring to think that this, when you read these excited passages from the lover to the beloved, that's the Lord speaking to his bride, speaking to his people, and speaking to each of us. This is the way he looks at us. All right. Lots more to talk about, but I'll leave it until next time. Questions about all that? I just encourage you to take some time over the next couple of weeks to slowly read through the Song of Songs, and ask yourself at each point, what is this telling me about God and his relationship to his people? What kind of God is this that's being revealed here as the lover? And what is his relationship to this church? Questions or comments?
You mentioned at the beginning, I think it was Bernard of Clairvaux, you said, saw the bride as allegorical of the soul of the Christian.
Right.
You've mostly talked about the bride as a corporate allegory of the
right.
church.
Right.
Is it one or the other or both?
Yeah, I think it's both. I know that there have been a couple of recent writers who have said that there's a shift in the understanding of the Song of Songs from more corporate understanding early on to more individual later on. And in my reading, I don't see that. I think that from very early there, both of them are going on. I'd say the same thing. The church as a whole is broad. That's really true in the scripture. But I think that you can think of each member as being corporate into the bride in relation to Jesus. Members of that bride, part of his body. So I think we can apply it individually as well as corporately.
So we men need to learn to think of ourselves
as
brides.
Yeah.
Rich, you told me that would be easy.
It's easier for some than for others, right?
Yeah, obviously you have to shift. You have to shift register in some respects. But I think the kinds of things I was saying about from the beginning of chapter 4, I think the import of it applies to individuals as well as to the church. That's another place I think where there's a New Testament allusion to it. In Ephesians 5, Paul talks about bride without spot or blemish or any such thing. I think that's the Song of Songs. That's clearly the church and Christ.
Yeah.
That's explicit. But and it's a corporate idea. But I guess I don't want to play those two off against each other. I think you have to think of them together. Definitely more of a stretch for guys than otherwise.
If we're reading it as an allegory, what does that make the meaning of the refrain? The I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem, do not start working up until it pleases. Is that an exhortation against trying to predict when Christ is returning and all the various times people have claimed that he's coming soon, he's coming now, here, you know?
Yeah. Those adjurations come up several times in the poem. And I'm trying to remember now what I conclude about it, because I know there's some difficulty in knowing exactly, just even literally, what's being said. It's saying, don't arouse or awaken love until she pleases, until it pleases, until love is ready. And I don't remember what my conclusion about that was. I wouldn't go in the direction you suggested, that it's, put it allegorical like that, but more has more to do with maybe this would be the direction to go. That being a good lover is timing. Other things too, but it's timing. Doing the right thing at the wrong time is the wrong thing to do. Saying the right thing, but saying it at the wrong time. As the perfect lover, the Lord knows how to arouse love in the right time, at the right pace. That would be a direction to think about it.
Allegorically speaking, you have the bride and the bridegroom. You also have the daughters of Jerusalem. Yeah, right. Who would they be allegorically?
Yeah. Well, I think, again, you have to shift registers. The best, and I have a hard time making, well, if you think not Yahweh in Israel, but Yahweh in Zion, or Yahweh in Jerusalem, and then the daughters of Jerusalem, I think, the towns, the children of Mother Jerusalem, the other parts of Israel, or the children of Jerusalem. So you can think about it, Yahweh, Zion, and the rest of Israel. Another layer of it, and this is what the way Luther took the whole poem, is that it's a song of praise from the king to his people. So again, it's the king praising the beauties of the capital city, but also the beauties of the whole land and all the other towns and cities. So, I think that's the Jerusalem in its, and the rest of Israel, who are often pictured as the children of Jerusalem. And you have that in Isaiah and a bit, where Zion is the Lord's bride, and yet Zion has children, who are the Lord's children, but in some way they're both the same thing, they're both Israel, but distinguished between mother and children. But is that, you call that?
Yeah. Maybe analogous to the way the New Testament speaks of church as both bride and mother.
Yeah. Right. In that regard, the bridal imagery is paramount in the Song of Songs. That's obvious. I'm not sure that the mother imagery is entirely absent of both in the Daughters of Zion idea. And also, just kind of reading back from Isaiah, but the section of Isaiah I talked about at Biblical Horizons this last a few weeks ago. It's in chapter 49, I think, when it talks about the Lord restoring Zion as his bride. She's going to be adorned, and her dress is going to be adorned with jewels. But those jewels are her children. So it's combining bridal and maternal imagery really directly. And I wonder if something similar is going on in the song. Other questions? Comments? Rejoinders? Complaints? Refutations?
What about in verse 15 that we read of chapter 2 that says, catch us the boxes, little boxes that's full of vines?
Yeah.
And it says her brothers, so that's obviously something that's trying to attack her in some fashion, or...
Leave it to Jessica to be curious about the brothers. And
well, we were just talking about daughters of Jerusalem, and I think that was the only part that said her brothers that I could see when I was skimming.
Oh, where are you seeing it?
Chapter 2, verse 15.
You got brothers in there?
I don't have any brothers.
Oh, it says her brothers. Well,
in the New King James, the New King James marks out this speakers, and obviously that's editorial, right. Interpretive. So,
yeah. I do have a theory about the foxes in a second, but there are some references to brothers which are kind of mysterious. My mother's sons in 1:6. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me caretaker of the vineyards, but I have not taken care of my own vineyard. They seem kind of...
They don't seem very good.
No. But then there's a... they seem to be speaking in 8:8. We have a little sister. She has no breasts. What shall we do for our little sister on the day that she's spoken for? And then toward the end of the poem, there's another reference to her vineyard. Verse 12 says, "My own vineyard is at my disposal." So she seems to. I think that I've taken that as part of the elevation of the bride. She starts out kind of under the kind of oppressed by her brothers, it seems, supposed to work out in their vineyards. But then at the end, she seems to have mastery of her own vineyard. There seems to be some kind of progression there. The best thing I've heard about the little foxes is. The foxes are seducers who enter the vineyard, plunder the vineyard, ruin the vineyard being the woman, take off the fruit of the vineyard. And what the exhortation is, when they come into your vineyard, keep them there. Don't let them come in and steal, plunder you and steal your fruit and run off. And that makes some sense at the verse 15 and the beginning of verse 16, was his exhortation to catch the foxes that are ruining the vineyards. And then there is the mutual possession in the first half of verse 16. So the sequence seems to be the foxes are coming through the vineyard, they want your grapes. Catch them, don't let them go. And verse 16 seems to say that that's what happened, that she caught them. They are in her vineyard permanently, not just passing through and stealing grapes. Do foxes actually eat grapes? They do in Esau. Don't they? Isn't there a story about fox and grapes? Mm-hmm. Do they actually do that, though?
I don't know. They ate my cat's food.
That makes sense to me, but grapes, not so much. Anyway, that's the best I'm able to make of that. That was one of the favorite lines when I taught this in my graduate class. Nice little foxes bringing the vineyards.
So Peter, if it's an allegory, would you say we should interpret the Song of Solomon the way Jesus interprets his parables? Where you can sort of go through and say, this means that.
Yeah. I'm not saying that, no. I think it's much looser and much much more complicated. It's not an allegory in that same way. And I think that's the way that it's been, efforts have been made to read it that way. The Wasit at the beginning of chapter 4, because this is the bride and the bride is the church, every single one of those features corresponds to something very precise in the church.
Right.
The teeth are the teeth in Augustine's reading, the teeth are the ministers of the church who make the food digestible for the rest of the body. That's what you're doing every Sunday here.
Hopefully.
Chewing it up. Anyways, I think that leads to fairly wooden readings of the poem. There are allegories that are like that in the Bible, but I wouldn't classify this one as that.
Well, let me ask the question that I'm sure everybody's wondering about. Why does he say your two breasts are like fawns? The twins of a gazelle. I mean, what does that mean?
Breasts are like the ministers too.
How so?
You got to spell that out for
us. So really, I'm nursing you.
You got two of them on front of church.
So really, I'm nursing you on Sundays. Is that what you're saying?
Okay.
See, this is getting really weird.
Too far.
I'll wash my hands on this.
Like one of those mother birds that pre-digest the food.
There you go.
I don't know what a number. I don't know what a lot of these particulars are about. mean, you can think again. There's some visual, maybe some visual correspondence. You know, symmetry. The breasts are symmetrical. But I think the probably visual analogy is very secondary. I think it's more associations of associations of landscape and land, and not so much the visual. But I don't know. I'm not sure how to handle a lot of these particulars. I know I don't want to do certain things, but I'm not sure what to do on that.
We should go read Bernard.
Since you brought up the breasts, that's what keep going. Well, I think it is interesting in the Song of Songs is the first place that I think in the Bible. There are some other places. Well, I guess Proverbs does mentions the Proverbs 5 talks about the.
We discussed that.
But before this, there's a. You know, when Bressler mentioned the Pentateuch or the historical narratives up to this point, it always has to do with nursing. It's never an erotic thing. It's never an object of beauty, it's always a child at the breast. And I think that it's, I do think you have to read that the two together. I don't think there's a pornographic fetish. Fetishization of different body parts, you know, that you detach body parts from the person, and you detach the body from the created use of the body, and that becomes something that's a pornographic outlook on a human body. You're looking at something just for the physical shape and arousal that it causes, rather than taking it as a whole person, and also thinking, you know, breasts are for nursing. And even when he's talking about the beauty of her breasts, I don't think that's been lost. I don't think he's isolated from that. Although I don't want to go in that weird direction we were going a second ago, but it does kind of go, it wants, I want to go back in that direction, sort of, to think about. Yeah, what her body is. He's celebrating her body, not just its beauty, but its created design, as it were. Did I shut down discussion? Too much breast theology?
What are we talking about next time?
Ryan wants to know if it's worth coming back.
Well, I mean, I think it makes sense. Like, I don't know. I guess we have been talking a lot about sex, but, like, the idea that, like, you can't necessarily separate the body from the spiritual, but, like, God values all of it. Like, the whole person is what I would take from that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, again, it's a perversion of sexual desire to make it just a bodily thing, rather than a response to a person. And the body is a kind of manifestation of the person, of the soul, rather than just an object or a machine that you've got a little soul driver inside that's keeping it going. That's not the way the Bible talks about it.
Well, the allegorical reading of Song of Solomon fits really well with what we talked about in the book of Proverbs with sex, that sex is always more than physical. It's never just sex in a bare physical sense. It always has a symbolic and spiritual dimension to it. And obviously, if Song of Solomon is this layered text, that's inevitable. But that's very clearly part of it.
Were you asking what we're doing next week?
I mean, I was just joking.
I did want to go talk more directly about what the Song of Songs teaches about sexuality next time. So I'll pick up some of the last things.
Yeah, I'll be there.
It sounds like I'm going to...
He doesn't have a lot to learn here. He kind of knows all that. But he'll come anyway.
It sounds like he probably overlap with some of the things you said from Proverbs.
Yeah, that won't be bad at all.
Well, let me pray. Father, I'm grateful to you for your son Jesus. We thank you that he is the divine liver who has come to give himself for his bride. We thank you that he loves us with a love that is stronger than death, with a jealousy that's fiercer than Sheol, with a flame of love that cannot be quenched, which is the very flame of God. We praise you that that love has taken flesh and come among us, and that the Spirit that is poured out from that embodied love lives in us. And we pray that you would fill us with that Spirit, that you would fill us with the flame of Yah, so that we would love you as you loved us, and that we'd love one another as well, with the same love with which you loved us, the same sacrificing love. We thank you for this book and for the beauty of it, for the challenge of it, the riddles and mysteries that are here. We pray that you would train us to be more responsive to your word as we study this book.